Stuart Schimler of American Pioneer Music. Stuart, tell us a little bit about not just the album, but the company and where you come from. How'd you get into something like this? Now, I should just mention, so people understand where we're going with this, this is an album we're introducing today of the campaign music from the 1864 presidential campaign. Seems like kind of a niche thing, but your interest is a little broader. Is it more history or more music?
Well, you know, it's actually an equal balance. I think to have an appreciation of the music, you need to know a little bit about the history and the context. But the basic background of the project and the company is American Pioneer Music was founded to produce campaign songs and old American music from the 19th century. And if you're familiar with the type of music that's produced from this time period, a lot of it is not really authentic in the sense of the types of lyrics that are recorded. There was a time in the 19th century where minstrelsy was the most popular form of American music. And that, those tastes changed and it fell out of fashion. So when minstrel songs would be recorded in, let's say, the 50s and the 60s, the lyrics would be adapted and they became children's songs. So songs like Oh Susanna and Camptown Races, as we've heard them in our lifetime, are really more a reflection of our own time period than authentic 19th century music.
It was a little harsher then, wasn't it? A little more pointed music in those days.
Exactly.
It would be politically incorrect to do today, probably.
Much so. And the music in the 19th century was really written for adults. So all the music that was on the minstrel stage was really designed for adult males. And it was a very rowdy environment. And what I wanted to do is really introduce that type of 19th century music for adults, because what's produced now is really for children or reenactments. So what we're really going for are people who are interested in United States history and really want to hear the words of the people who lived in that time frame. And I think that a lot of things we see in entertainment today when we talk about the 19th century really have the words and the character of current writers. And it really talks more about our view of the past rather than what really occurred.
You know, it occurs to me that the music would be so organic, it might be the best representative of the tenor of the times. If you want to go back and see what people were really thinking and feeling, the music might well be the first place to go.
I think that's actually just the way that I was thinking about this project as well. And if you look at how these songs were produced and the types of tunes that were used for these lyrics, especially in presidential campaigns, the lyrics are written to popular songs. So to learn the lyrics themselves is very easily. All you have to do is set out a set of lyrics. People see it on the page, Battle Hymn of the Republic, and they could start singing instantaneously. So messages could spread very rapidly and quickly.
Now, music back then wasn't as ubiquitous as it is now. I mean, you couldn't go to your iPod or the internet or your CD player, or even your cassette player. Even four tracks hadn't been invented by then. So this was really about publishing, wasn't it? People would come up with a song and write it and sell printed copies so folks could play it around the piano at home, the old upright, huh?
Exactly. You know, so music was much more of an organ for social growth and communication. And what we see now is really is the personalization of music. Someone walking down the street with their iPod. But back in the 19th century, music was a very important part of how people talked to each other and related with each other. So buying music was much about buying a piece of sheet music at a local store and bringing it home and singing it around the piano with your family. And the growth of campaign songs really came out of that type of culture.
Now, I also I'm sorry. Go ahead, David.
Yeah. When did that change? When did that become when did music not become what it was in the 19th century, a kind of an attempt to sell sheet music and attempt to promote certain activities versus a kind of a personal expression. When did that change over? 60s, 1960s?
No, actually, I would say that the trend started to shift when radio became popular in the 1920s and the 1930s. More importantly, you know, at that point, once there were record companies, you also didn't need to see music live. You can now enjoy it always in the comfort of your own home. But if you were going to experience music as a group, if you went to the minstrel theater, it was very well known that men after work or on weekends would go to this rowdy environment. So remember, this is also a very male-dominated culture as well. So you don't always have the idea of women going to the minstrel theater, at least in its beginnings in the 1830s and 1840s, was almost unheard of.
Well, so music was really a group activity. Now you kind of isolate yourself with music. But back then, we were a nation of farmers still. People isolated on farms and on in frontier areas of the country. I think the chance to get together around a banjo or a guitar or a piano was probably just a golden opportunity to hobnob with some fellow human beings.
Oh, it was. And if you think about exactly what minstrelsy was, it's actually almost a reenactment of slave and plantation life. Of course, it carries a lot of different biases and perspectives of the people creating the music. However, you could see on the stage it is a form of social organization, and it's imitating what was actually going on in plantations. After the working day was done, all of the parties and energy that was still present when the sun went down.
Well, here's a question that might help us zero in on the 1864 campaign. Were the whites envious of the music heritage and abilities and skills and talents of the blacks?
In some sense, yes, because in reality, the creation of minstrelsy itself is an imitation of black culture. So there is, I'm not really sure if I could agree with the exact wording of your word choice.
Envy might be the wrong word. Imitation, though, certainly.
Right. The imitation was definitely there. And that imitation, you can argue, was also somewhat of a poor characterization as well. We don't know necessarily how representative the creation of minstrelsy really was to black culture. This is an entire area that historians have debated for quite some period.
Was it a caricature?
It was a caricature. Mm-hmm. And one that what's interesting is even some of the minstrel stage performers who were black would also dress up in blackface. Mm-hmm. So all of the performers actually weren't white, which most people really don't know. But the majority of them certainly were white, and this was their interpretation of the mannerisms of slaves on the plantation.
More now, akin to a Polish joke.
Yeah, something. I think it was something along those lines. But what's really important is that campaign songs grow out of this musical culture. And what happened in 1840 was the big dividing line when William Henry Harrison started to really usher in the modern campaign. And that included banners, poems, campaign buttons, little medallions, and also campaign songs. So starting in 1840, every 4 years, there would be this huge increase in political music, music that's specifically written for presidential campaigns. And 1864 is somewhat representative of those years.
Well, you know, there was a long-held tradition, and probably still is in parts of the world, with hymns in churches all over Europe and the U.S., and that is when a new song had been written, that is, the lyrics to a song, there was something called a hymn book full of hymn tunes, which was a collection of familiar tunes. And the author of the lyrics would pick out a hymn tune that would go with the meter of his words. And it was a pretty slick way to teach a congregation a new hymn because they already knew the melody. Now, I noticed that every song in this album is actually a parody of a song that was already out in general circulation.
Precisely. And I think it's very good, actually, as a very good lead-in to one of the songs on the albums talking about hymns. One of the most popular songs during the Civil War was called The Battle Hymn of the Republic, or John Brown's Body. And it was actually built upon an old church hymn that became popular in the 1850s called Say Brother, Will You Meet Us? And this was a very religious song. Say, brother, will you meet us? Say, brother, will you meet us? Say, brother, will you meet us on Canaan's shore? Mm-hmm. And, of course, the chorus line was, glory, glory, Hallelujah.
Now, I've got to ask you a question about that song, because it was what, Harriet Beecher Stowe that wrote what we know as the Battle Hymn of the Republic. She had heard the Army of the Potomac in Washington singing this song, but to the words of John Brown's Body. A political parody and of John Brown, the abolitionist. But there's also stories out there that the song itself actually came from Scotland. It was an old Scottish barroom song. Say it was a hymn.
Right. There's a lot of debate over the origination of a lot of these tunes, because a lot of individuals modified them slightly from a tune that they heard.
Borrowed
before.
Them. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. So even a song like When Johnny Comes Marching Home, it's argued that it actually was originally from Ireland, the song Johnny, I Hardly Knew Ya, which mm-hmm. is an anti-war song. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of argument over which one actually came first. So it's very hard sometimes to pin down exactly who a songwriter is. And this is almost the problem with the first real songwriter in the 1800s was a man by the name of Stephen Foster.
Yes.
Who wrote many of the songs that we know today. But he never was paid royalties when someone would swipe his song and put new lyrics attached to it. So when he died in 1864, he died penniless. Right now, songwriters collect royalties from songs they wrote 50 years ago and are very, very well to do. So that type of culture, that type of law and copyright law really wasn't established back in the 1830s.
You could see larceny as the great American pastime, I suppose.
Or you could compare it to developmental economies like China today, which don't respect intellectual property when it comes to something like software. Mm-hmm. So it's almost the same thing when America was developing. We didn't have that legal infrastructure in place.
Yeah, well, mankind just hasn't changed. It's been a downhill since the garden here, I think. Let's listen to this song. This is the Republican campaign song. That's how Stewart has titled it. Let's listen to this by the American Pioneer Singers, and then we'll take a look at the history of the song.
Lincoln and Johnson will guide the ship of state. Yes, Lincoln and Johnson will guide the ship of state. Yes, Lincoln and Johnson will guide the ship of state. In 1865, the Star Spangled Banner will triumph in the end. Yes, the Star Spangled Banner will triumph in the end. Yes, the Star Spangled Banner will triumph in the end. In 1865, we'll hang all the copperheads high in the air. Yes, we'll hang all the copperheads high in the air. We'll hang all the copperheads high in the air in 1865.
Republican campaign song from the Lincoln Johnson campaign of 1864. Well, David, are you convinced? Would you vote for that guy?
Maybe.
Are you in favor of hanging the copperheads?
More about him. What's his immigration? How does he feel about IRS scandals? Oh, that's right. Internal Revenue Service was the beginning in those days, and it was ruled unconstitutional.
That's true. Yeah.
Yes. And in terms of immigration, remember the Republican Party is an outgrowth of the American Party, which were the nativists or the know-nothings in the 1850s, right. And they were consumed in the Republican Party. So a lot of those in the Republican Party were definitely, you could say, restrictionists.
Mm-hmm. Sealed the border. Right. Yeah, put the border fence up, and everybody that's in here now, you get to stay. All the rest of you guys, stop it. Just go back where you came from.
Yeah. You know, and campaigns were different then, too. If we go back to the Revolution, in the early part of the 19th century, presidential candidates did not campaign. It was considered unseemly to go out and tout your own talents and aspirations in public. Other people did it for you. But by this election, it was conducted from the back of trains, wasn't it?
Yeah, you know, there's the big change in American culture, and in the old days, historians called it the era, starting in the Jacksonian period, of universal manhood suffrage. Remember that the way people elected their presidents in the early republic was much different. Almost every state had some sort of landholding requirement. So only property owners could vote. And by the 1830s, most of those restrictions were lifted, and virtually all male citizens were able to vote. So once you had a change in the electorate, you had a change in how politicians communicated with them. And if you notice the types of people who became president in the 1840s and 1850s, always ran on a war record. And that's why the William Henry Harrison campaign in 1840 was so important, because it really was a model for so many future campaigns.
Zachary Taylor,
Tippecanoe, and Tyler too. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Zachary Taylor as well. And what you need to know really about the military backgrounds of many of these guys was it wasn't really that successful. Even the Battle of Tippecanoe, which Harrison talked up, was a very minor skirmish. These were not people who were frontline generals in storming the beach in Normandy. Mm-hmm. And it's very important to understand that.
Well, until maybe General Grant.
Yes. General Grant was definitely someone who was very closely attached to military campaigns. But if you look at even a lot of comments of the soldiers at the time, he made a lot of risky moves that maybe wasn't very considerate of the lives of his soldiers. Mm-hmm. So at the time, he had a lot of haters, but after the war, you know, the mythology and how these people represented themselves in campaigns are what we remember today.
Well, glory was attached to war, especially when you won, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And what's important about 1864, you could see how in this particular Lincoln song, how it's really all about our brave soldiers returning home in glory. He's campaigning on how the war is great and the war is going to restore the Union, and we're not going to have any concessions to the South.
Tell us about the Copperheads. Who were the Copperheads?
Yes. So the Copperheads are the brand of Democrats who were against the Civil War in the North. Many people today believe that the North was for a war and people in the South seceded, and there were only two points of view. But there were definitely people within the North who were very much against the Civil War and just wanted the South to go free. They said, who cares if they secede? We're independent states anyway. And we don't mind if the Union doesn't go forward as it existed in 1860.
Were they perhaps textile owners that profited from cotton shipped from the South to England? Because that was a huge factor in this.
Well, that was definitely a lot of the factor of support in places like New York City, mm-hmm. Which was sort of it had its own brand and its own opinion. But I don't only look to economic motives here, because there are definitely people who had strong political beliefs. And the idea of states' rights was still something that was very powerful, not only in the South. Many states within the North believed that states had the right to secede as well. And they were afraid of large federal power moving in on their beliefs and their way of life. So there was definitely a strong political motivation for not supporting the Union in the Civil War. And the Copperheads were that political representation.
And well, the song made no bones about it. Hang 'em high in 65, huh? That was the notion
of states' rights comes from the founding. I mean, that was from the beginning. The founders were very concerned about an over-present, over-powerful federal government and insisted that individual states had the right to nullify laws.
Right.
Some of those were very, very strong arguments in the beginning. And, you know, those arguments continue on today. There's still states that insist that Obamacare is a wrong thing to do, and by their authority as individual states are standing firm and saying, no, we don't want to sign on to it. So states' rights is probably just as strong an element as many of the other elements we were talking about that in the cause of running up to the Civil War.
Exactly. And remember, those arguments were even amplified in 1864 simply because of the measures that Lincoln took to put down the rebellion. But because you had so many civil liberties in the North, such as freedom of speech, Lincoln took a lot of hard-handed measures to suppress the opposition, to suppress the Copperheads. And this included, besides having military zones in the North and in states like Missouri, it also included shutting down Democratic newspapers, which were critical of his administration. So the Copperheads in 1864 were definitely running on a platform. McClellan, it's important to note, wouldn't have considered himself a Copperhead. His McClellan's position was sort of muddled. The Democratic Party was running on a peace platform, but McClellan himself didn't necessarily support that publicly. It sounds like he may have gone on with the war and maybe come up with a negotiated peace, but he was in a very strange position because his party was very anti-war, and he still had his support of a lot of soldiers and was a military leader.
Well, we're going to hear a song from the other side, the loyal or maybe not so loyal opposition. This one is called Shouting Our Battle Cry, McClellan. Stuart, give us a little background on this song.
Well, Shouting Our Battle Cry, McClellan is to the tune of a very popular Civil War song called The Battle Cry of Freedom. If you look at any movie about the Civil War period, including Spielberg's Lincoln, you hear the battle cry of freedom at different portions of the movie, especially at the end when they pass the 13th Amendment in Congress. Everyone bursts out and they start singing it. So it's a very popular song. And in this particular ditty, we find that the McClellan's supporters are looking at they make some astute political points regarding the gold standard. They come out against the income tax, and also they use some very vulgar language to support some of the policies of the Lincoln administration regarding slave emancipation and the Emancipation Proclamation.
Well, let's listen to the song and zero in on some of those lyrics. This is Shouting Our Battle Cry, McClellan.
Yes, we'll rally round the polls, for McClellan is the man to lead us in a fight for the Union. We will march up to the box, let him win then best who can, and thus fight for McClellan and the Union. McClellan is a watchword, hurrah, boys, hurrah. So down with the Joker and up with Little Mac. While we rally round the polls and vote the hero in, shouting the battle cry, McClellan. Oh, we want no more high rates, no more galling income tax, nor greenbacks such as Chase used to utter. We are specie payment, need the high duties to relax and bring down the price of bread and butter. McClellan is a watchword, hurrah, boys, hurrah. So down with the Joker and up with Little Mac. While we rally round the polls and vote the hero in, shouting the battle cry, McClellan. We want to change your cabinets, and McClellan is the man
make it for old Abe's not able. We want no more rank niggers near the White House frying pan, nor to sit at the head of the table. McClellan is a watchword, hurrah, boys, hurrah. So down with the Joker and up with little Mac, while we rally round the polls and vote the hero in, shouting the battle cry, McClellan. We want no bogus generals from the White House kitchen board who boast of their red tape education, who go south to fight and kill but forget to use the sword while preaching their slave emancipation. McClellan is a watchword, hurrah, boys, hurrah. So down with the Joker and up with little Mac, while we rally round the polls and vote the hero in, shouting the battle cry, McClellan. So we want no smutty jokes, but we want a man of deeds to lead us with a firm hand of reason. So we'll dress old Abraham in a cabinet's widow's weeds and mark him the last joke of the season. McClellan is a watchword, hurrah, boys, hurrah. So down with the Joker and up with little Mac, while we rally round the polls and vote the hero in, shouting the battle cry, McClellan.
Shouting our battle cry, McClellan, from the American Pioneer Singers. And we're talking to Stuart Schimler of American Pioneer Music about this album, this CD of campaign songs from the 1864 presidential campaign. Stuart, the word greenbacks popped out at me because I read it. We just passed the anniversary of the day when Congress authorized the printing of paper money. And I did not realize until I read that little blurb that we did not have paper currency before then. And they did that to finance the war. They were going bankrupt, huh?
Yes, exactly. There was paper currency that was issued by local state banks. And the monetary history of the United States is very interesting. It's a very long conversation. But this was really the first time that there were federal greenbacks.
But it must have been controversial then. I mean, because they pointedly mentioned it.
Yes, it was very controversial, and the fact that you could hear the McClellan supporters are for the gold standard. They say hard specie payment need the high duties to relax. And there's also a reference to Salmon Chase, who's the Secretary of the Treasury, because on those greenbacks, he put his own picture. And of course, he wanted to be president, and it was a great way to make himself known to the American population.
Yeah, talk about campaign flyers. That would work.
That definitely works. And this is what the McClellan campaign and people in the North were so concerned about, how America was dramatically changing. There was a lot of inflation during the war. That's why the song talks about the high prices of bread and butter. And what I think is most interesting here is that they were connecting the printing of greenbacks, moving off of a gold standard, directly to the higher prices they faced every day. Because a lot of times in the modern world, people don't make the connection between monetary policy that happens by the Federal Reserve and the prices they pay for gas, butter, or cheese. So this was definitely a major point of contention, and the Democrats hit it home in 1864 over and over again.
David, very pointed lyrics, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, very interesting stuff. And the Stuart, have you ever been to the new Lincoln Museum in Illinois?
I have not.
Oh, it's carve a space of time out for yourself and go there. Spend about 3 days. It's an outstanding presentation of Lincoln's young life and his primarily displays about his days in the White House. But very, very, very neat stuff. It's very interesting. One of the things that I remember very specifically, we're getting off McClellan a little bit, but there's a hallway that leads from one of the rooms, I think it was the Oval Office display, and then through to where the war was fought. They've got a large map on a wall where battles were fought, and then they chart electronically the number of casualties. And you can watch the development of the war and the casualty number rise in the space of about 6 minutes. And in this hallway are recorded messages of people criticizing Lincoln and, you know, calling him names and, you know, not criticizing by, you know, in the high-handed niceties that we sometimes use today. Well, we think you're just wrong. I mean, yeah, he was called an ape. He was called a monster. He was called a gorilla. He was, you know, the Joker is something that I'd never heard before. But based on the, you know, his telling of stories,
smutty jokes, as we heard in the first song. Yeah,
interesting. Back to McClellan. Did you know he's buried in Trenton?
Yes, he's a New Jersey man. New Jersey was also one of the three states that he carried in 1864. But I think you actually made a lot of good points in calling him an ape and a monster and everything else. Yeah, honestly, I think that may be just coming from other Republicans. Yeah. Because if you know what his cabinet was really a creation of a lot of political backroom dealing that happened in 1860. You know, Lincoln was not the front runner for the nomination. So if we go back 4 years, at the time, most people thought William Seward was going to be the nominee, but he carried a lot of baggage. And Lincoln was a bit of an unknown. And that's why he was a better fit and a better chance for Republicans to take the White House. So a lot of hatred was by just Lincoln's own cabinet. They didn't respect him very much, and they all thought they could do a better job than he could. And obviously the Democrats really hated him. And the Joker reference, if you don't mind, Jim, I just want to investigate that a little bit. There was a popular story that was running sometime in 1863 that Lincoln, while he visited a battlefield, he was telling dirty jokes, and he wasn't sympathetic to soldiers. So when that happened, or when this story started to circulate, you find a bunch of political cartoons that make reference to this. And sometimes you see these weary soldiers and pictures of McClellan helping soldiers out on the field while Lincoln is in a suit and telling dirty jokes and singing songs. So this characterization of Lincoln became very popular running up to this election. And this song is a perfect representation of that. He tells smutty jokes, and we're going to mark him the last joke of the season, as the song says. Mm.
Well, campaigns were knocked on, drag out affairs back then, weren't they? They didn't, the bare knuckle fights.
They were. Mm. Yes. You know, these were also brutal battles that lasted a long period of time. You know, the official campaign season still started after the conventions. So it really started in the late summer. But what was really important is that Lincoln thought that he was going to lose this election in 1864. And part of the reason why is he didn't have the big military victory yet. It wasn't until the end of the summer, until Sherman took Atlanta, that it was a foregone conclusion that the Union would win the war.
Gettysburg didn't do it for him, though.
Mm. Gettysburg was a turning point, but it wasn't a factor in necessarily killing the South. Mm. They still had more in them. Mm. And all the South really had to do was hold out. If the Democrats would have won the election in 1864, it's very possible that there could have been what's called a negotiated peace, meaning that the Democrats would have come to some concession for the South, whatever it would have been. That could have been restoring the Union, or it could have been letting them go. But they were about negotiations, whereas Lincoln wasn't about it. He wanted a military victory. He needed it, and at the beginning of the summer of 1864, he did not have it.
David, any thoughts?
Thousands of thoughts. I mean, that's one of the big things. And, you know, I keep thinking about or I keep hearing the notion that Lincoln was the only one that kept the Union together. Of course, he didn't keep it all together all by himself. There were others who were in favor of unions as well. I guess during this conversation, I was thinking that the folks who were in favor of a large federal government tended to be those who supported Lincoln, of course, but also who wanted to, take extra legal measures to make sure that that happened. One of the things that, that struck me during the movie, Lincoln, that was released last year, is that this particular portrayal was away from the deification model. They took the halo off Lincoln's head, and he was shown as a sharp, specific, exact, plotting politician who knew what he wanted to get to a particular aim and knew the steps to get there. And, we got to talk to this guy and this guy and this guy, and this guy won't vote for us unless we talk to him and give him this and this and this. And all the stuff that we've not really heard before, because all we can hear about, all we can see about is Uncle Abraham going to heaven. Right. And that's the deification. The same thing happened to Franklin Roosevelt. I mean, we looked at him because he was killed in office, or because he died in office, or I'm not sure why, but we've glorified the memory of the man and ignored the policies that got him to where he was.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, and that's part of the reason why on this album we've got 60 McClellan songs, many of which rip Lincoln apart. And then you've got the 6 Lincoln songs, and the last one is actually post-election. It was written after he died. It's called On the Death of President Abraham Lincoln. And the reason why the album closes with that song, the reason why I put it last, besides being written to a beautiful tune, an old Scottish song called Annie Laurie, which is a very lovely end to the album. But the real reason it's last is because that's the image that we have of Lincoln. It's that because he died in office, he became a hero. But also there are political reasons why Lincoln has been elevated. Yes, in the North, he saved the Union. And originally, of course, African-American voters always considered Lincoln was the one who gave us freedom. But also the South had a reason for supporting Lincoln. Because if you look at his last inaugural address, he speaks to the fact of not harming the South after the war is over. And Reconstruction was a very brutal time. So what the South was able to do is say, well, Lincoln wouldn't have treated us this way. He wouldn't have deprived us of our votes. He wouldn't have forced through the 14th Amendment or the 15th Amendment for us to get back in the Union. And that's why the entire country, for many years after the Civil War, rallied around Lincoln. It wasn't only because he was killed in office, but it was because there were so many political reasons to put Lincoln on a pedestal.
Sure. We're talking with Stuart Schimler from American Pioneer Music, and we're talking specifically about an album of music, Abraham Lincoln and the 1864 Election. Stuart, how can people get a hold of the album?
Yeah, so there are a few ways. It's available for download at digital music stores like iTunes and Google Play. And the physical CD is available on Amazon.com. And for more history about the songs and links to all these sites, you can go to www.electionsongs.com, which is the official site of American Pioneer Music.
Okay.
Do you plan on going and doing other projects on other campaigns?
Absolutely. This is definitely a long-term goal. There will be more albums and more campaigns. At first, we'll probably center around the 19th century, mainly because these songs, I believe, first of all, they've been laying in the archives for over 150 years and no one's seen them. And they also possess a lot of character and really are, this is, I believe, the true heart of the age of political campaign songs. So the antebellum period and the remainder of the 19th century, I think, will definitely capture attention from most people.
Well, with any luck, we'll hear some more campaign songs coming up soon. They've been kind of neglected, I think. I haven't heard any campaign songs here lately. They just don't do that anymore. I guess they're too nice now, too civil.
Leading into it. Yes. Sounds like that.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, well, you're basically able to find them still on the internet in a different capacity. They're not central to the campaign, but if you remember songs, even the last in 2008, you had the Obama girl video. Mm. You know, those types of characterizations, those types of songs are what's going on now. They still exist. They're just not as central to the campaigns.
Stuart Schimler from American Pioneer Music. It's been a delight. Thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. And we'll conclude appropriately with another listen at one of the greatest hits of 1862 or thereabouts, this from the Susquehanna Chorale and Aura Lee.
From my heart, the answer.